going to return to the book that I wrote called Questioning Paul. You can find it if you'd like to read it. It's a little over 1,200 pages at questioningpaul.com. And we've been reviewing it now for better part of 6 months, and we will continue to press our way through it. And the part that we had to come to on our program Friday is that we completed Yahweh's review of Paul in Habakkuk. Habakkuk, Chabaouk in Hebrew, means embrace this, was considered to be a minor prophet just because it's a very short book. It focuses in the first two chapters on a singular individual, Paul, and the religion he created. It is the most important prophecy in the whole Torah, prophets, and Psalms because it affects the most people. And in it, Yahweh laid out, Yahweh's God's one and only name, 666 years before Paul would write his first letter, this letter to the Galatians, which is where we have returned in the text of our review, the context of our review. He said everything you can imagine that would be important about Paul. He called him out by name. He said, this individual, his name is Shaul, which is Paul's given name. He talked about his audience being Gentiles. He told us that he would contradict Yahweh's requirements and responsibilities as they're articulated in the Torah. He said that he would do this at the time that the Moed were being fulfilled, which is when Yahusha was in Jerusalem fulfilling Passover, unyeasted bread, Bukurim, firstborn children, and Shavuot, the promise of seven. He said that he would use circular reasoning, that he would be wholly and completely dishonest, that he would claim to speak for God while contradicting everything that God had to say. And he said that he would be affronted during his life by the rock, which is both Yahusha, the rock of our salvation, and by Shimon Kefesh, who was renamed the rock, and these are exactly what happened. The Sermon on the Mount is a broadside to Paul. The Olivet Discourse is a broadside to Paul's credibility. And Shimon Kefesh's second letter was written almost entirely to undermine Paul's credibility. And it goes into such detail that it tells us that the fixation that Paul's going to have, the line that he's going to draw, distinguishing his religion from the teachings of Yahweh and the Torah, would be circumcision. And that he would convince people that they do not need to be circumcised, that circumcision, he would say, in his parlance, would be counterproductive. And that is where we rejoin the text of Galatians. You see, the text of Galatians tells us that Paul was brought to Jerusalem because of circumcision. And the book of Acts also affirms this in far more detail, but Paul is giving a backhanded slap to it here. Paul's assuming that you know what took place at the Jerusalem summit, where he was called to Jerusalem to account for his extraordinarily deviant testimony. And it's his response to it, and it assumes that you know what took place there. So it's my goal to fill you in so that you're aware of this. Paul was saying that circumcision was not only unnecessary but counterproductive. Yahweh says circumcision is required and is productive. Yahweh and Paul had the opposite position. And it's a rather important issue for Yahweh and for us, because if you are a man and not circumcised, you cannot participate in the covenant, which means you cannot form a relationship with God. You cannot engage in Passover, which means you cannot become immortal. Therefore, you cannot be saved. And if you're not circumcised, according to Yahweh, you cannot enter his home, which is heaven. And Yahweh is very clear. It says you have to be circumcised both of the flesh and the spirit. And Paul says, no, circumcision is of the flesh, and of the flesh, anything of the flesh is evil, and that he came up with a new covenant. Yahweh doesn't have a new covenant. A new covenant that is based on eliminating all things that were part of the original covenant, and by negating the very sign of the covenant, circumcision. So as he goes into this meeting and comes out of it, he says, to the contrary, Allah, by way of contrast, not even Titus, a Greek, was compelled to be circumcised. And so Paul is twisting this to infer that he prevailed, that a decision was made that Greeks don't have to be circumcised to be saved. That's his position. But Paul is a really clever dude. He says that he wasn't compelled to be circumcised. Yahweh doesn't compel anyone. God, in fact, is wholly opposed to compelling anything. Hasatan, the adversary, being a lord, is into compelling people. To compel is to force. It's to pressure. It's to obligate. It's to necessitate. Yahweh doesn't do that. Yahweh does not obligate. I've said this before, but it's important for you to know. There is no Hebrew word for obey. When you read your English translation, your religious translation of what's called the Old Testament, and that tells you a lot right there, and a book called the Bible, which tells you even more. Bible's the name of a pagan sun goddess. And there is no Old Testament, and there is no New Testament. There's only one Testament, and it is wholly distinct from what is called the Christian New Testament. And in it, since it's all presented in Hebrew, there isn't a single word that actually conveys obey. Now, your religious Bibles, they'll say obey, but what they're doing is changing the meaning of shama, which means to listen, to obey. Now, why would they do that? Because religious leaders and political leaders want you to obey them, so they just simply change the word, which means listen, to obey. Well, since there is no Hebrew word for obey, you can't compel. Even what's called the commandments aren't commandments. Yahweh never calls them commandments. He calls them the 10 words, the 10 statements. And of those 10 statements, not a single one of them is a commandment. There was only one that was actually written in the imperative mood, which is the only form of Hebrew grammar that can convey a command by where you're compelling someone. And yet, the vast preponderance of the time that the imperative mood is used in Hebrew, it's not a command at all, but instead an expression of volition, of choice, of free will, which is the antithesis of compelling. Yahweh has three moods in Hebrew that convey volition. First, second, and third person volition or free will. He does not have a single word to convey obedience. That tells you a lot, doesn't it? So God is not into compelling us. He's not into ordering us. As a matter of fact, in the one of the 10 statements that actually uses the imperative mood, it's the one where a command is impossible. It happens to be the one that speaks of valuing your father and mother. It is speaking not of your earthly parents, but of your heavenly father and spiritual mother, the set-apart spirit. And this choice to value, to view as significant, kabud is the Hebrew word. It doesn't mean to honor. It means to view as weighty, as in there's something here that is worthy of your consideration. Something that you ought to value. Something that you should see is highly significant. Kabod. It's based on a word that also conveys glorious. And it's to see your Heavenly Father and Spiritual Mother in these terms, and that is something you cannot command. You cannot command respect. You cannot command love. That's why even especially in that one statement that's actually written in the imperative mode, it is conveying volition. The free will to make this choice. It's an attitudinal decision. So, God doesn't compel anything. He never compels anyone to be circumcised. He just tells you that if you want to be part of the covenant, you're going to be circumcised. And one of the terms and conditions of the covenant is for parents to circumcise their sons. So, Yahweh, for example, issues 7 invitations each year for us to meet with him. The first of these is Passover, Pesach. And he tells us if you're not circumcised, don't participate. It's not compelling you to be circumcised. You're not compelled to attend Passover. You're invited to attend Passover. You're not compelled to participate in the covenant. You're invited to participate in the covenant. The invitation has some terms and conditions. You're not compelled to do any of them because it's an invitation, not an order. The 7 invitations to meet with God, by the same token, they're invitations. They're not command performances. He doesn't compel you to attend. And so here Paul is making a distinction that is absolutely lost on Christians. Christians think, well, the fact that Timothy was not compelled, he was not forced, he was not obligated to be circumcised, that the disciples capitulated on this and Paul prevailed. The circumcision is counterproductive. It's not necessary. Well, A, God wasn't consulted, because if God had been consulted, he's made his position clear on circumcision. It's the sign of the covenant. No circumcision, no participation in the covenant. You're not participating in the covenant. You have no relationship with God whatsoever. And you cannot be saved. You cannot go to heaven. But the disciples, knowing this, would never compel anyone. It's your choice whether or not you wish to participate in the covenant. And therefore, circumcision is never compelled, as is anything associated with God. Those who may place greater confidence in the McReynolds English Interlinear that's associated with the scholastically adored Nestle Allen Greek New Testament 27th edition. Here's a rendering of that same statement that isn't my own translation. What I previously read to you is my own, and as we go through this, I will share with you several English translations. I will share with you an English translation of the Latin Vulgate. I will share with you the King James. I typically share the New Living Translation and also the interlinear that's associated with the most scholastically adored, you can't even call it a manuscript, but resource, which is the Nestle Allen Greek New Testament. What the Nestle Allen is, it's a blend of popular manuscripts. It makes the claim that it's adjusted to the oldest manuscripts, and yet almost every place where there is a difference between P46, for example, which is dated to the late first century, the oldest and most complete source of the Pauline letters, that every place that it differs, that differs from the most popular manuscripts, the Nestle Allen does not pick up the change. In other words, they're lying about being adjusted for the oldest manuscripts. But nonetheless, it is part of this process where I think we all benefit from an amplified translation of what Paul wrote, a literal, complete, an accurate translation. But by the same token, I want to share with you the other translation so that this case against Paul is not based entirely on the work that I have done to render the words as accurate as possible. So again, Here's what Paul wrote. To the contrary, it's from Allah, by way of contrast and making a distinction. Not even Ode, Titus, this is Titos, a Latin name meaning nurse. Now, the popular manuscripts read, the one with me, which from O Sin Ego, I did not share that with you because of the fact that it's not in the oldest manuscript, Papyrus 46. A Greek, this is from Helen, being, Emi, existing, was compelled, anagkazo, was forced or pressured, necessitated or obligated. This was written in the aorist passive indicative, indicating that he was acted upon in the past to be circumcised. The word that Paul chose for circumcised was peritimno. It means to be cut off and completely separated from peri, concerning the account of near and all around, and tomo teros, to cut something so as to create separation. This also was written in the aorist, this time also the passive and the infinitive, conveying that time, that at the time he was influenced in this way by the verb which has properties of a noun. Now, the Nestle Allen says, but not even Titus, the with me Greek being, was compelled to be circumcised. In other words, this was a fairly straightforward statement. We agree on the translation of the words to the contrary and but. Not Titus and not even Titus. Greek being, completely the same, compelled to be circumcised. We're also the same. The only difference is that they picked up a text. Their translation is from a text that's not nearly as old or as reliable as P46. So much for the myth that the Nestle Allen 27 has been updated to reflect the oldest extant manuscripts. There's nothing posterior to P46, and they ignored it. Now, regardless of one's preference or interpretation, someone actually trying to share Yahweh's message would have provided some context to explain and just an explanation as to why it would ever have been appropriate to force anyone to do anything. Think God doesn't compel. God does not issue mandates, and there are no obligations. We are all free to accept or reject the covenant. The choice is ours, and it is offered under the auspices of free will. It's an extraordinarily important aspect of Hebrew grammar. You see, Hebrew grammar, virtually every verb is accompanied by a stem that establishes the relationship between the subject, object, and the action of the verb, because all God cares about is our relationship with Him, and moods. And these moods almost universally express free will. Volition. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. During the break, Scott asked a question. I'm going to let him ask it now that we're back live, and then we'll devote the time necessary to answer the question. If Scott has the question, my guess is that there are others of you who may also have this same question. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, we were talking during the break about how Yah has more restrictions on himself than we have on ourselves because we get free will.
Right.
And my question was, eventually, He's going to write the Torah on people, so people lose their free will, and then they follow the Torah. My question was, what about those of us that are part of the covenant? What happens for us?
Yeah, actually, no one loses their free will. Right now, Scott, can you read the Torah if you want to?
Yeah.
If you want to ignore the Torah, can you?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
If you want to act upon the Torah, can you?
Yes.
If you'd want to not be guided by the Torah, is that your option?
Yep.
So you have the option right now to determine whether or not you're going to pay attention to the Torah and the option of whether or not you're going to respond to the Torah.
Yes.
That's totally your option.
100% my option. Yeah.
Okay. So complete free will as it relates to the Torah. Once you have read the Torah, listened to the Torah, come to understand Yahweh, who is the author of the Torah, and his instructions, and you have responded to them and become a member of the covenant. As a member of the covenant, do you have the option during the day to read the Torah?
Yeah.
Are you forced to read the Torah?
Not at all.
Can you choose, based on what you know about the Torah, to follow the advice?
Definitely.
Yeah. And if you choose not to follow some of the guidance that's in the Torah, is that also your option?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that's the way that things are now. And you recognize, Scott, that the lone purpose of the Torah is to introduce us to God and to share with us what he wants, what he is offering, so that we can choose to participate and capitalize on it?
I recognize that, yeah.
Okay. Now, so the Torah served for you as the means to get to know God and to engage in a relationship with him, and thereby to be saved by him.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Now, in eternity, now you're often exploring new solar systems and galaxies and just having a great old time in eternity. In eternity, do you need to be introduced to God?
No. I know him.
That's right. So that part of the Torah is no longer valuable, is it?
No.
No. In eternity, do you need to know how to form a relationship with God?
No.
No, because you already have a relationship with him. In eternity, do you need to know how to be saved for eternity?
Nope. Already done.
Already done. In eternity, do you need to know the consequence of religious behavior, or do you need to have any instruction of walking away from religion?
Not at all.
Okay. So the existing Torah is not going to do you a darn bit of good in eternity, is it?
Nope.
Nope. And the existing Torah is the single most important source of information that will enable you to get to eternity currently, correct?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it's the only way.
Okay. So when Yahweh returns, which is going to be on the Day of Reconciliations in year 6000 Yah, on our pagan Roman Catholic calendars, that would be October 2nd. At about 6:20 p.m. as the sun is setting in Jerusalem, although you will not see the sunset in Jerusalem if you happen to be here at that time because of all of the debris that will be in the air as a result of a whole onslaught of calamities. But that will be the time, and it's the Day of Reconciliations, October 2nd, 2033 in our pagan calendars. It begins at sundown on that day. Yahusha says that is not only the day that he's going to return and the day that he's going to reconcile his relationship with Yisrael and with Yahudem and Yehudah, but he says that he's going to affirm his covenant relationship at that time. And he says that there's going to be one thing different than it is now. And you've stated it. What is the thing that's going to be different as he affirms the covenant upon his return on Yom Kippurim in 2033.
He writes the Torah on people.
Right.
He writes it on their heart.
Okay. So, you have lost, perhaps, a tiny aspect of your free will. You can no longer reject the Torah. Is it possible to reject Yahweh's teaching, which is what Torah means, and be part of his family?
No.
So which the free will, the aspect of free will that you've lost, which is the ability to ignore the Torah, you no longer have the ability to ignore the Torah, but is it possible for you to ignore the Torah and be involved in a covenant relationship with Yahweh?
No.
No. So the only difference is that in eternity, we're going to have God's teaching written inside of us, which means that we're going to have a more accurate, more complete set of instructions on how to live in eternity. Do you expect those instructions and the Hebrew in them to change, and that God's going to invent a word for obey?
No, I can't. No,
no,
I can't see it happening.
So, you know, we're going to be empowered at least sevenfold. Because, and in each, by the way, of these empowerments is actually infinite, because we're going to go from 3.5 dimensions. We're a 3.5 dimensional construct now, height, width, depth, plus we are stuck in the dimension of time, and we're going to be able to experience a universe that is seven dimensions, and we're going to be empowered like the transition from matter to energy, from material to spirit. As you go off and explore the universe, are you going to want some guidance as to what things are safe to do and what things aren't safe to do, what things would be fun to do and what things probably wouldn't be?
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea what a black hole would do.
Right, so, yeah, that's a great example. You want, if Yana says, even as spirit, you don't want to get too close to one of these, here's the coordinates of them, that's part of my guidance. Would you like to have that?
I'd like to know that, even if it's just something simple. If this happens, just do this.
Right. You're going to be capable of time travel, because as light, time exists. You can move forward and backward in time. Are you going to want some guidance as to how to move backward in time so you don't screw things up?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. If you're intelligent and you reason things out, you'd want that.
Yeah. So the only difference between now and then is you're going to be given guidance that's going to enable you to safely enjoy an eternity of discovery direct from the creator of the very thing that you'll be exploring, the universe. And the only thing that's changed now is that you have a perfect copy of it and therefore cannot ignore it. But there's no word for compel in there, is there?
No.
No, so you don't lose any free will. Now, the interesting thing about this time that he writes his Torah inside of us, it's upon his return. What happens to those who are not part of the covenant when he returns?
They get set apart.
If you're not part of the covenant, when he returns...
He writes the Torah on your heart?
No. If you're not part of the covenant when he returns, what happens to you? If you're not part of the covenant when he returns?
You no longer... Or you're set apart.
You're just no longer
exist. No longer exist. Okay.
Right. There'll be two groups of people. There are two groups of people. Those who deliberately mislead and lead people away from Yahweh, who are openly hostile to Yisrael and to Yahweh. And now they are set apart. They're set apart into Sheol, which means they're judged and incarcerated in what suggestion is very similar to a black hole. And they are set apart into a black hole. But the vast preponderance of people are simply annihilated. Their souls cease to exist. So at the time that he writes his Torah inside of people, since his Torah represents him, is he going to write his Torah inside of those people that are going to spend eternity in Sheol, the Hebrew term for what people consider hell?
I think he will.
No, you won't.
I think you would. Why not? Show them exactly how they were wrong.
Because the Torah represents him. He can't go to the place of separation. He is wholly consistent with his Torah. His Torah, you want to see God, you want to meet God, read his Torah. Mm-hmm. He can't go to the place of separation, so his Torah will not be there. So he will judge them. They will find out why they were wrong, because he'll hold a trial for them. And they will be given the opportunity to know where they went wrong, what they did wrong, although most already know it. Now, those that are going to Sheol cannot have the Torah in them, because you can't take Yahweh to the place of separation from Yahweh. And those who are annihilated, obviously you can't put the Torah in something that no longer exists, right?
Right.
So the only individuals who get the Torah written in them are those who are part of the covenant. Wouldn't they have already made every choice that is germane in the Torah? in favor of Yahweh in the covenant?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is no loss of free will. What there is a tremendous gain of accurate information. Like, for example, now, we did a program on this past Friday where we were talking about the Devarim words, Deuteronomy 12. And there's a passage in there that says, so long as you're thoughtful about it, there is a period of time where you can eat whatever you want. And as we analyzed that passage, there was disagreement amongst some of the listeners as to what the words conveyed and who those words represented. And so we spent 2 hour-and-a-half programs going through each word and the potential meaning of each word. And this particular statement of Devarim is not extant in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So, you know, we're using the Masoretic and we're using lexicons and dictionaries to systematically analyze every word. That's not the most perfect way of learning or knowing, is it? Wouldn't you like to have a copy of Yahweh's instructions written inside of you? Absolutely perfect, so that you know exactly what he conveyed. There is nothing associated with God which is obligatory. And no choice should ever be compelled. An explanation, however, would have gone a long way toward helping people understand the symbolism involved in their decision regarding whether or not to be circumcised. You know, Paul just said that he was not compelled, that Titus was not compelled to be circumcised. You know, if he was speaking for Yahweh, if he was conveying the message that Yahweh shares with us in the first book of the Torah, in Genesis, Bereshit, in the beginning, where Yahweh lays out his stand on circumcision, what it represents as the sign of the covenant. It's the 5th of 5 requirements to participate in the covenant. Now, that's a requirement to participate in the covenant. Keep that in mind. It's not something you have to do. It's something you choose to do if you choose to participate in the covenant. If you don't want to participate in the covenant, you don't need to do it. And so, if Paul were speaking for God, he would convey Yahweh's position on circumcision. He would say, you know, the choice was Timothy's, or Titus in this case. You know, Paul didn't give Timothy a choice. He circumcised Timothy. But he should have said that Titus was given the choice. If he wishes to participate in the covenant, he would need to be circumcised. If he chooses not to participate in the covenant, then there's no need. If he chooses to participate in Passover and therefore go through the doorway to God's home and to eternal life, he's going to need to be circumcised. If he wishes to go to heaven, he's going to need to be circumcised. He doesn't want those things. Doesn't need to have it happen. So if Paul were speaking for Yahweh, he would explain Yahweh's position on circumcision because it's really clear. I mean, there are very few things, if anything, in Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms as indisputable, irrefutable, as absolutely clear as his position on circumcision, both of the flesh and the spirit. There is absolutely no place whatsoever where circumcision is replaced with something like baptism, which happens to be primarily a pagan concept. No place. There's no place where Yahusha tells us that we should baptize. There's no place where the instructions on circumcision are negated. And God can negate them. You know, he said the circumcision is an everlasting sign of the covenant. He says, I can't change. He says, don't add to, don't subtract from the Torah. Well, as Scott said a moment ago, there are more restrictions on Yahweh than they are on us. We live under the auspices of free will. We can choose to ignore or to pay attention to the terms and conditions of the covenant. Yahweh can't. He must. He has put himself in a position where he has to do what he has said he would do. He can't change. He said so. So, had Paul taken the time to explain why circumcision was chosen as the sign of the covenant, which is a really interesting perspective and insight. If he had taken the time to explain what the consequences were of free will and of choice, then this would have been a meaningful discussion. But to say he was not compelled to be circumcised is to say, I understand and believe that my audience is really stupid. And because my audience is stupid, I can choose to do whatever I want. I can fool them, and I'm going to fool them. And so that's precisely what we see taking place here, is God having a very clearly articulated position and Paul choosing to deceive on the very subject that's most important to Paul. This is the topic that Paul is most concerned about. What we see here is pure deceit. Deceit in a very conniving way. So, all of these things are very important. It's extremely important that you recognize them, that you understand what these things mean, and how the letters written by Paul were specifically designed to confuse. But here we have Paul admitting that the issue which brought him before the disciples was the very one that Yahweh said would do so. We'll be with you tomorrow.